Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The legacy of racial discrimination in the American financial industry is long and pervasive, especially towards Black Americans. Blacks have long been denied home mortgages, favorable interest rates, and even basic financial services, widening the growing wealth gap in this country. Proving racial discrimination has often been difficult, but New York Times reporter Emily Flitter was able to do just that in her latest piece about racism against a Black employee and a wealthy Black customer at a J.P. Morgan Chase bank in Phoenix, Arizona. Emily, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Diedrich Asante-Mohammed, Chief of Race, Wealth, and Community at the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. Great to have you here, Diedrich.
Thank you.
Emily, you talk about two people in this latest story. Let's talk first about Ricardo Peters. I want to play some audio that you were able to obtain about his interaction with a white supervisor at J.P. Morgan Chase.
She's losing her Section 8, so her rent goes up, so now she needs money to pay all the bills. And now she's flush with cash that she's never had before in her life.
But if there's no somebody to intervene and show her how to do it,
right? That doesn't matter. You can intervene all you wish. She doesn't understand this. This is not money she respects. She didn't earn it.
This is not money she respects. She didn't earn it. Okay, who's Ricardo Peters in that audio interview, and who are they talking about?
So Ricardo is a financial advisor for J.P. Morgan, and he's talking to his boss, Frank Venero, about a customer he met who had just received almost $400,000 in a settlement after her son died. And she had come into a Chase branch, and Ricardo thought, I can help her. I can manage her money. And his boss was telling him, no, you can't. He's talking about how she's from Section 8. That is a coded term that refers to poor Black Americans. Frank is saying, Mr. Venero is saying, essentially, there's no use in trying to help this woman with her money because she doesn't respect it. It's not something that Chase admits. In fact, they say that Frank Venero did not know the race of this woman. Ricardo says that he did know it.
You also, Emily, you wrote about Jimmy Kennedy, who's a former NFL player who is very wealthy, talking a couple million dollars here. What was his story?
Jimmy was a defensive tackle in the NFL for 9 years. He won the Super Bowl with the Giants in 2012, and then he retired. He moved to Arizona and put about $800,000 into Chase accounts with the understanding that he would be made a private client. Chase offers the private client status to people with, they say, $250,000 or more in investable assets. Mr. Kennedy was told that he had well in excess of that, obviously, and that there would be no problem making him a private client. And yet, more than a year later, he was never made a private client. He didn't understand why until another employee at the Chase branch explained it to him.
You also have a recording of some of that explanation. What was the explanation that at least was told about Mr. Kennedy?
Mr. Kennedy says that at one point he actually thought he had already been made a private client. So he went in and a teller or, you know, somebody who is sort of on the front lines dealing with customers said, no, you're not. He received reassurances that, you know, they would set things right and they would make him a private client and they would get everything squared away. And it just wasn't happening. I don't think he got a clear explanation until he spoke to a financial advisor named Charles Belton. Charles told him that Mr. Venero, who he had gone to escalate the problem, just wanted to get him out of the branch because he was afraid of him because he was a big Black man.
Diedrich, we're hearing about this case in Phoenix at this Chase Bank there, but we know that discrimination in the financial services industry is pervasive. How prevalent is it today? I mean, are these isolated cases or are you seeing things like this happening throughout the country?
Yes, well, we at NCRC have been doing actually some fair lending testing, particularly around entrepreneurship across the country. And we've seen, I think one thing that's important to note is that we've seen how poor the service is to small businesses as a whole. Right. And I think this story, and I love this story because I think it highlights so many of the challenges we see in the investment in the banking industry, which we all kind of rely upon to help strengthen the finances of most Americans. And so, you know, we've seen just poor service to smaller businesses, period. And then we see even worse services to African-Americans and Latinos. And actually, in February, we'll be breaking out some of our data along gender lines as well, race and gender lines, to get a better understanding. So we do see this type of prejudice, discrimination. But I think what's also important to bring forward is I think this story also highlights that there is a lack of understanding of racial economic inequality, racial wealth inequality, and a lack of broad support that this is something the financial institutions should be addressing. I mean, I love the conversation with, Ricardo Peters, where he's saying, you know, but isn't, you know, this person might not know what to do, talking about the woman who came into $400,000, might not know what to do with her money for investment because she's never had that type of money before. But isn't that why we're here? And his manager is clearly like, no, that's not why we're here. We shouldn't be dealing with them. So I think it brings up so many important issues.
I want to get into those issues, too, because I think it's important what you're raising. These are issues that also just affect poor Americans across the board who aren't used to having options, financial options. But before we do that, Diedrich, I want to ask, are there laws that are in place to protect against this type of financial discrimination?
Well, I mean, there clearly are laws to protect against outright, I will not serve this person because they are black, right? There is, you know, that type of protection. But I think, you know, what we're seeing and what, you know, in this story, and there's laws that should be protecting these black employees who are trying to do better to their community. But we also see how well, how subtle it can be. And I think, and the reporter can correct me if I'm wrong, the main reason this was able to become a big story is because we had the unusual circumstance of actually tape recorded conversations where people are, you know, where you can prove what people are saying versus kind of what happens in the back room and we never see.
Emily, that's a big part of this story, is that it's often so difficult to prove discrimination. When you got the tapes, what did you think as a reporter?
I have actually been working on this subject for a long time. There are a lot of other cases out there that are hard to write about because they're hard to prove. Actually, a number of the major banks over the past 5 or 10 years have reached really big class action settlements with black employees. Banks have actually started to take steps to prevent employees from forming classes to begin with.
Diedrich, I want to go back to something that you mentioned about sort of how banks struggle, really, whether that's intentional or not, to understand the needs of black and brown communities and low-income communities in accessing wealth management and accessing some of the broader investment tools that they have available.
Yeah, you know, I've done a lot of work looking at different major banks, and we've seen that in many ways, you know, these banks haven't done well. Some of these banks are doing interesting things. It's interesting. J.P. Morgan Chase launched last year this thing called Advancing Black Pathways, where they were recognizing that they weren't, I don't know how much this was about the investment sector, but in general, that they didn't have enough blacks throughout their banking system and needed to create stronger pathways to deal with this. And I think that was really important, but what I think we're seeing is that hasn't spread out through the entire J.P. Morgan Chase system. And again, I want to put forth, you know, if you don't understand that the reason for this deep inequality economically is because of structural racism, historic disenfranchisement, then people do get into this mindset that, well, these people just don't know how to deal with money and we don't want to be associated with them.
Emily, increasingly we see large banks like J.P. Morgan Chase and others just sort of taking over, you know, big parts of the city. I think every corner there's an ATM from one of these larger banks. But there are also smaller banks, black-owned banks. You've interviewed people who are customers of black-owned banks. What's the difference in the experience there?
In reporting this story, I got to know the largest black-owned bank, which is One United. And I spoke to some One United customers who switched their accounts over to One United from one of the big four banks. They describe a really night and day difference in service. And so, for example, I spoke with a woman in Southern California who had had her money in Bank of America. And sometimes there were times when she would literally not be seen. She would be standing in line and somebody would call on the person standing behind her to serve them first. So she moved her money to One United, which has a branch in LA. And she says when she goes in, the employees recognize her. They say hello. They call her by her name. As soon as she walks in the door, she doesn't have to remind anybody. And she has found that at One United, that's where she gets treated like she's an individual and, you know, a valued customer.
Diedrich, to that point, I mean, Black-owned banks are critical, but there are less of them that are owned by Black Americans today. How do you, I mean, is that part of the solution, do you think, for Black and brown Americans to start seeking out services that aren't part of the quote-unquote mainstream financial services industry?
Well, I mean, you know, one challenge is Black and brown people do that all the time at check cashing spaces and at payday lenders. And that's another place where you also see oftentimes much better customer service than we have in our in our big financial institutions.
But you also see large fees there.
Oh, yes. No, and I don't mean to recommend that people go to check cashers and payday lenders, but I'm highlighting that it's part of the problem that these, you know, financial institutions that are supposed to be the good places to get services, get money, aren't treating people well. But again, I think all of this has to recognize it's important to the country as a whole that we better serve median income, but let's say low wealth, moderate wealth Americans, because we have such growing financial instability, and that's bad for the country as a whole.
Diedrich Asante Mohammed is chief of race, wealth, and the community at the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. And Emily Flitter is a banking reporter for the New York Times. Emily, Diedrich, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.